This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Most of us are trying to find more time every day to get things done, so you can't let trips to the post office slow you down. Now you don't have to, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your own computer and printer. You'll never waste valuable time going to the post office again. Sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a four-week trial, plus $110 in bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. Stamps.com, and enter UNDISCLOSED. UNDISCLOSED is also brought to you by 23andMe. Your DNA is made up of 23 pairs of chromosomes. That's why the name of the product is 23andMe. 23andMe is a personalized genetic service that helps you understand what your DNA says about you. 23andMe is the first and only genetic service available directly to you that includes reports that meet FDA standards. With 23andMe, you get more than 60 personalized, detailed reports on your health, traits, and ancestry, plus tools that allow you to share and compare your genetic reports with family and friends. Here's how it works. Order your DNA kit from 23andMe.com. Provide your saliva sample from home and mail it back to the CLIA certified lab. You'll be notified when your reports are ready online. More than 1 million people around the world have experienced their genetics through 23andMe. Order your kit today from 23andMe.com.
Notwithstanding that hopeful expectation, actual coverage, meaning receipt and sendings of calls throughout Lincoln Park, still remains difficult, does it not?
Yes, it does.
So my question was, notwithstanding your expectation in the design of your network that you were selecting the optimum site for your cell tower to receive and send cellular signals seen to be seen by all manner of cellular phones that the coverage area designated was expected to cover what you so designated, the difficulties in sending and receiving phone calls throughout the coverage area that includes the designated parts of Lincoln Park continue to be problematical. Do they not?
Objection.
Sustained. You do not have to answer that question. And counsel, if you would like to restate it and phrase it not in a compound fashion and in a different tone, the court might consider it.
I appreciate that offer, Judge, but I will pass.
Hi, and welcome to the 14th episode of Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Sayed. This week's episode is Tina. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and a national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, I've mentioned before how amazed I am at the collection of fascinating, enigmatic, and odd people who've touched this case. It is sometimes hard for me to decide which of them has had the most impact on the case, but perhaps the strongest contender has always been Christina Gutierrez, who was called Tina by those who knew her. To this day, people can't decide if she was a tenacious, amazing defense attorney, a bulldog on the pant leg of justice, or a tough bully who bit off more than she could chew with little regard for her clients, lying when she had to, dropping balls and hurting their cases. The thing is, maybe she was all of it.
Given this young woman's prior record, how can we know that her demonstrated qualities of dishonesty, untruthfulness, and lack of candor will not again rise to the surface? We are unable to see inside her head. A person's character is far more accurately indicated by his prior actions than by all of the recommendations that could possibly be made by good friends. Once certain shortcomings have been indicated by one's actions, a person simply should not be placed in a position where he may succumb to temptations similar to those which have led him astray on earlier occasions. I suggest that an employer would not place a convicted but reformed embezzler in a position to handle substantial amounts of money, a convicted but reformed pimp in charge of a woman's dormitory, or one convicted of unlawfully distributing controlled substances who is likewise reformed in a position to supervise drug distribution for a legitimate drug supply house. In fact, in any of those situations, I dare say that if a case were to reach us involving a fall from grace of such individuals, my colleagues would be inclined to comment that the employer's action was analogous to contributory negligence. Under the circumstances, I feel that I would be derelict in my responsibility to the people of Maryland were I to join in certifying that this young woman has the requisite moral character to handle the affairs of others. Nevertheless, I wish her well in the practice of law and hope she will prove my fears unfounded. This language comes from the dissenting opinion of Justice Marvin Smith in response to the application of Christina Gutierrez for admission to the Maryland Bar. Justice Smith, however, was outvoted, and October 26, 1982, Gutierrez undertook a legal career that would reach the highest of highs before descending to the lowest of lows. But today's episode begins 35 years earlier.
In 1947, Roberto Gutierrez, a World War II veteran, married Mary Teresa Shuttle, whom he had met at a USO dance in Baltimore during the war. In 1950, his partner and he established Footner & Company, an international freight forwarding and customs brokerage in Baltimore. Mary served as their corporate secretary. In 1951, Christina Gutierrez was born. She was the second of 10 children. This was 60 years before Baltimore was desegregated, 11 years before the version of Baltimore portrayed in John Waters' Hairspray, and decades before the Baltimore of David Simon and Freddie Gray. Gutierrez eventually went to high school at Notre Dame Preparatory School, one of Baltimore's oldest Catholic college prep schools for girls. According to the Baltimore Sun, with her pronounced Mexican features, she was keenly aware of bias against her, particularly at Notre Dame Preparatory School, where she says she was belittled by the school administration despite being a top student. After graduating from high school, Gutierrez did not attend college. Instead, she took on a series of menial jobs and became engaged in political activism, eventually becoming one of the most recognizable activists in Baltimore. She also started dating a man who became physically abusive and caused at least one miscarriage. It was at this point, in 1971, that she was arrested for shoplifting at a department store. Bail was set at $10. Neither her parents nor her boyfriend were willing to post bail for her. The next day, she pled guilty to shoplifting. However, the conviction was not under her legal last name. It was under her boyfriend's last name. Gutierrez claims that she didn't use a false name in order to hide the conviction or to hide her legal troubles. It was just that she was in an interracial relationship and that she consistently used his last name so that people thought the two were legally married, which she thought might blunt criticisms of the relationship. This was not a good time in Gutierrez's life. Over the next 2 years, she became increasingly disillusioned with the U.S. government, Richard Nixon, and the Vietnam War. In 1973, she joined a group of young Americans who went to Cuba to cut sugarcane. Gutierrez was surprised to learn that the Cubans there were critical of her bitterness towards the United States. According to Gutierrez, they asked me how I could give up my country and how I could hope to change it if I perceived myself as an outsider.
Gutierrez eventually returned to the United States with the goal of being a lawyer. She got her undergraduate degree at Antioch University in Baltimore and then followed up on that by going to the University of Baltimore Law School, eventually graduating in 1979. Now, normally, this would have been followed immediately by taking the bar exam, being admitted, and becoming a practicing attorney. But when Gutierrez applied to the Board of Law Examiners in Maryland to be admitted to the bar, her past finally caught up with her. She admitted in her application that she had hidden her shoplifting conviction for the past decade. She didn't disclose it when she applied to be a bailiff in 1975, And most importantly, she didn't disclose it on her law school application. Indeed, according to Gutierrez, she had concealed that shoplifting conviction on each job application she had submitted since 1971. Despite this prior conviction, and more importantly, despite the cover-up, which is really what's important to bar examiners, the character committee of the bar voted 4-3 to approve her, and eventually so did a majority of the justices of the Court of Appeals of Maryland. Those justices found that Gutierrez should be commended for her frankness in coming forward when, as Susan noted, the conviction was under a different last name and therefore could have gone undetected forever. This takes us back, though, to the beginning of the episode and Justice Smith's dissenting opinion. According to Justice Smith, while it's true that Gutierrez's conviction was under a different last name, her arrest was actually under her legal last name of Gutierrez, and a report to the Character Committee from the Baltimore City Police Department noted that arrest. And so in discussing that, Justice Smith noted the following. He noted, "With that report, it is highly improbable that an alert character committee, such as the one in the 8th Judicial Circuit, which considered her application, would have failed to interrogate the applicant and the subject. Moreover, since she disclosed in her application for admission to the bar that she had also been known by the name that appeared in her arrest report, I strongly suspect that once that Baltimore City Police Department report was received, any investigator worth his salt would have uncovered the conviction promptly. Accordingly, that argument carries absolutely no weight with me."
Yeah, Colin, so her arrest was actually under Christina Gutierrez, correct?
Right.
And then she used, for the plea deal, she entered a different name?
Right. That was, again, as you said, the boyfriend she was dating at the time, his last name she used, right, I guess when she was pleading guilty, somehow she changed that last name, and that was the name under which the conviction was entered.
I mean, she might have gotten away with it if she hadn't come forward, but I don't think the odds were very good that would happen. And if she had been caught not disclosing it, there's not a chance in the world she would have gotten through the bar committee.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we tell our law students all the time at my law school, disclose, 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 because if you're forthcoming, your chances are pretty good. If you're caught in practice having lied or not disclose something to the bar committee, that's it. You're going to be disbarred and no two ways about it.
Yeah, the time to do it is before law school.
Yeah, I mean, we have things like where someone was just questioned by police. They weren't even arrested, or it was just a traffic citation. We say disclose everything with an abundance of caution.
Yeah, it is surprising that she was eventually admitted to the bar.
Yeah, and Justice Smith, in his dissenting opinion, noted some of these issues we were just discussing. Here's another part of his dissenting opinion. "It is evident also from a perusal of the transcript of the hearing before the character committee that some members of the committee believe she was not completely candid in her explanations of her driving record and the fact that a number of motor vehicle fines went unpaid over a number of years." So Smith's concern wasn't just about the shoplifting and failure to disclose it over a decade. It was that even when she was sort of coming clean to the character committee, there were question marks there about exactly how candid she was being. And then ultimately, that leads Justice Smith, again, to conclude he can't in good faith admit Gutierrez to the bar. Here's one final section of his dissenting opinion. "The practice of law often involves handling the funds of clients running into tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of dollars. This can and does present a temptation to some individuals, as experience has amply demonstrated. Therefore, I regard honesty as one of the most important traits of character which should be required of a prospective lawyer. He should be forthright and honest in all of his dealings, but particularly when the funds and property of others are concerned. When a person is admitted to the Maryland bar, he becomes an officer of this court. When we admit them, we are in effect certifying to the general public that he is a person to whom the affairs of others may be entrusted safely."
Justice Smith was the dissenting opinion, though. And Gutierrez was admitted to the Maryland bar on October 26, 1982. For the next 4 years, Gutierrez plied her trade not as a private attorney and not handling clients' funds, but as a public defender, where she represented indigent clients. According to the Baltimore Sun, she soon became considered one of the best in her office. In particular, she tried more cases than anyone else and rarely accepted plea deals. As a result, she often drained the public defender's budget by retaining an abundance of expert witnesses. According to a colleague at the time, Gutierrez was the most tenacious lawyer he'd ever seen, and, quote, "You push her, you better be ready to kill." In the end, though, it was Gutierrez who cut ties with the public defender's office in 1986 after becoming worn down by the fights with her bosses. That was the same year that her divorce was finalized. We're not sure when she was married, but 1986 would be the last year that she'd ever be married in her life.
Soon after quitting the public defender's office, however, Gutierrez was in fact courted, but it was a different type of courtship. In 1983, William Billy Murphy had started a law firm, and he soon became known as one of the top trial attorneys in Baltimore. In fact, when State Senator Clay Davis needed an attorney on a 2008 episode of the TV series The Wire, he hired Murphy, who was playing himself. When Gutierrez quit the public defender's office, Murphy pursued her vigorously to be an attorney at his law firm. According to Murphy, she loved to try cases. She would, as we would say, throw down in a minute. She had no fear in the courtroom of anybody or anything. Gutierrez soon accepted the invitation, and at that point in time, Murphy and Gutierrez began to front one of the top litigation firms in Baltimore. You can almost get this visual image of them and their firm as this real-life counterpart to, if you've ever seen the show The Good Wife, Lockhart Gardner, you have basically these two larger-than-life figures literally creating real-life drama in the courtroom. For instance, here is a representative quote. It comes from a Baltimore criminal justice blogger describing one of their cases. In 1994, the city comptroller, Jacqueline F. McLean, went to court on charges of stealing city funds. The case quickly became a circus with the aggressive defense attorneys M. Christina Gutierrez and William H. Billy Murphy, egging on Judge Elsbeth L. Both. Judge Both, who had a volatile temperament in the bench, allowed herself to be drawn into shouting matches with Gutierrez and Murphy, who did not want her on the case. Over the next 9 years, Gutierrez won more than her share of professional victories. In 1991, she won an acquittal for a Morgan State student who had been charged with murder, despite the fact that the student had made various self-incriminating statements to the police. In another case, she spared a client from death row by delivering her entire closing argument from behind her client so the jurors wouldn't be able to take their eyes off of him before rendering their verdict. She's also believed to be the first lawyer to raise a successful battered spouse syndrome defense in the state of Maryland. In fact, in 1990, she became the very first Hispanic American woman to be counsel of record before the United States Supreme Court. The case at issue was Maryland versus Craig, and it's a case that's in evidence casebooks across the country. Craig was a child sex abuse case, and in the case, the trial judge approved of a unique procedure. With this procedure, the child was in a separate room testifying with only a video camera, the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney, Gutierrez, being present. Meanwhile, the defendant and the jurors were in the courtroom and could only see the child on the TV screen. In the case, Gutierrez successfully argued to the country's highest court that this procedure violated the Confrontation Clause, finding that this closed-circuit testimony did not protect the defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him. Gutierrez's successes led to her being profiled in a Baltimore Sun article on May 15, 1994, A Bulldog Tenacity in the Courtroom. It's the source of much of the information that we're using this episode. The article notes how, over this course of years, there were few, if any, Maryland lawyers who had handled as many high-profile criminal cases, with Gutierrez almost always winning those cases. Here's a representative excerpt from the article. Some prosecutors privately question whether Ms. Gutierrez's successes are a triumph of style over substance and assert that her pugnaciousness is manipulative. Ms. Gutierrez becomes venomous over such criticism. Quote, "There are some prosecutors who accuse any defense lawyer who beats them as being dishonest and using trickery. I have nothing but contempt for them." The article makes clear Gutierrez's status at her law firm at the time, because at that time, Murphy himself was facing charges that he battered his wife, and it was Gutierrez who he chose to represent him. And in fact, she eventually won his acquittal. But even at this point, we can see in the article that Gutierrez's work seems to be taking its toll on her. The article notes how she contracted pneumonia while representing Murphy. She worked around the clock for days when she was working on cases to the point of collapse. And the article also indicates that at some point in time, Gutierrez had adopted both a son and a daughter And the article explains how on Saturdays she would typically spend the day at home with her children before the sitter arrived. At that point, she would leave, she would go to the office, she would basically burn the midnight oil and work throughout the night before then reappearing to see her children at breakfast.
That doesn't sound like a sustainable lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like something you might be able to sustain for a while, but it's not something that you can really maintain over a course of years. And in fact, it looks like that toll eventually did play a part in Gutierrez's later decision.
And I thought that it was really interesting to see what the unnamed prosecutors thought about her style back when she was at her strongest. And I suspect there was probably some merit to their criticisms of her and to their accusations of style over substance.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that Gutierrez was always walking a fine line between the amount of time she spent on case prep versus the courtroom performance that she was going to put on in the trial. And it seems to me that over the years, those scales tipped more in favor of the latter to the sacrifice of the former.
Yeah, she seemed to have good instincts in the courtroom, but she wasn't exactly someone you'd want writing your appeals brief.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that, you know, a lot of attorneys, they're blue bloods. They come from money and they might not be able to relate to a Baltimore City jury. Gutierrez definitely was someone, I think, through her history of growing up and seeing herself as an outsider to her political activism, was someone who was keenly attuned to what jurors were thinking. And assuming the prosecutor is correct that there wasn't much substance there, it was made up for with her style and her ability to convey to the jurors exactly what they needed to hear.
I also wonder if it may have contributed to Judge Quarles' accusation that she was lying. Maybe he had seen her in action before and had decided wrongly or rightly that she was capable of trickery or capable of trying to pull procedural stunts in the court, and that this might be just another stunt.
Many things that are written online about Gutierrez, even her supporters said that she walked that tight line between what's ethical and what's unethical. And I think for a while she navigated it, and she navigated it successfully. But, you know, as 1994 turned into 1995, seemed that there's a shift, maybe a slight shift at first, but also in a certain sense, that shift, I think, started a gradual at first and then a more severe decline in terms of what she was doing for her clients.
About a half a year later, in January 95, Gutierrez ended her professional relationship with Murphy. According to an article in The Split, she hoped to better control her workload and to spend more time at home with her family. She then began a limited affiliation with the Baltimore law firm Redmond, Bergen & Cruz. But almost immediately, problems started cropping up with her cases. When she first joined the new firm, she was primarily working on two cases. The first was the case of John Merzbacher. Merzbacher was a teacher at a Catholic school in Baltimore who was charged with a number of sexual crimes against an 11-year-old student. After a jury trial, he was convicted and sentenced to four life sentences. Merzbacher appealed and claimed that Gutierrez and her co-counsel had failed to communicate with him about a plea deal that the prosecution had offered. Under the deal, which the judge had approved, Merzbacher would plead guilty in exchange for 10 years incarceration instead of the four lifetimes that he did get at trial. At Merzbacher's post-conviction hearing, Gutierrez testified that she failed to communicate the offer because she was moving offices when the offer was made, and it was, quote, out of her mind, later when she was working to prepare for trial. So by the time the court rendered its judgment, Gutierrez had been disbarred, and the judge used Gutierrez's disbarment to support his finding that Gutierrez had perjured herself when she testified that she never told Merzbacher about the plea deal. After all, the court reasoned, how could she make such a glaring mistake when she claimed to have worked so hard in the case? Which seems like a pretty terrible catch-22 to me. The judge found that she was so incompetent that her claim that she'd been incompetent in Merzbacher's trial couldn't be believed. Merzbacher eventually appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. That court disagreed with the state court, finding that Gutierrez had indeed forgotten to communicate the plea offer, and that this satisfied the deficient performance prong of an ineffective assistance claim. The failure to communicate such an offer is a glaring error that a good or even decent lawyer cannot make. That said, the court concluded that Merzbacher would have rejected the plea deal, even if it was communicated to him, meaning that there was no prejudice and no relief for Merzbacher.
Yeah, so in other words, Gutierrez, in this case, completely screwed up. You can believe she committed perjury. You can believe that one of the central duties of any attorney to communicate a plea deal to a client didn't take place. And ultimately, court finds Merzbacher probably wouldn't have accepted the plea deal, so there's no prejudice. But that doesn't speak at all to the failures of Gutierrez. It's one or the other, either perjury on the one hand or, again, failing one of the central tenets of an attorney to disclose a fairly favorable plea deal for a client who, based upon his conviction and sentence, that was a substantial discount, that offer, which he might have rejected, but it was certainly something that he should have been told, so he would have had that option. Now, in addition to claiming that the plea deal had slipped her mind because of her office move, Gutierrez also cited another case as a contributing factor that had distracted her in representation of Merzbacher. That client was Lori Cook. Like Merzbacher, Cook had also been charged with sexually abusing a student, but unlike Merzbacher, at her criminal trial in 1993, she had secured an acquittal based upon Gutierrez's representation. And then while still at Billy Murphy's firm, Gutierrez had also convinced a hearing examiner for the school system that the abuse allegations against Cook were unsubstantiated. Now, fast forward to April 1995, again, just as Gutierrez is transitioning from Murphy's firm to her new law firm, at that point, she thought she had negotiated a deal with the school board attorney pursuant to which Cook would voluntarily resign her job in exchange for a clean personnel record. In other words, there would be no record of the sexual abuse allegation, and it would be fairly easy for her to try to secure a job somewhere else. Instead, though, Cook turned out to be fired with cause, and this left Gutierrez, by her own admission, outraged and feeling like she had been set up by the school board. According to the school board president, the school board attorney was not technically speaking on behalf of the board, which had not approved the deal that Gutierrez thought she had secured. So this is a case of basically a school board outmaneuvering Gutierrez and leaving her with a client who thought she had a deal that, in fact, sort of vanished into thin air.
There was also a third major case that Gutierrez was handling in 1995, the murder trial of Leon Green. Green was charged with murdering Paul Hutchinson on January 9, 1995. The state's key witness in that case was Sharon Webster, Hutchinson's girlfriend, who claimed that she saw Green and Hutchinson walk into an alley, heard gunshots, and then saw Green running away with a gun in his hand. The case went to trial, and on August 1st, Green was convicted of murder and sentenced to life without parole. Green filed for post-conviction relief, claiming that Gutierrez had been ineffective by not moving to modify his sentence. The Court of Special Appeals of Maryland agreed and found that Gutierrez had been ineffective, which meant that Green could now belatedly move to modify his sentence. In addition to his claims about modification of sentencing, Green also claimed Gutierrez was ineffective because she had requested and received an alibi witness instruction. That instruction tells jurors that they should return a not guilty verdict if they believe the defendant's alibi witnesses. The problem in this case was that Gutierrez called no alibi witnesses, and therefore, according to Green, this instruction merely highlighted the fact that he didn't have an alibi defense. The Court of Special Appeals agreed with Green and found that Gutierrez had been deficient in this regard, but concluded that this error was not enough to change the outcome of trial. But Green also claimed that Gutierrez was the reason that he didn't have an alibi witness in the first place. According to Green, he had informed her that he had two alibi witnesses who would testify in his defense, and he did so well before trial, but she never once contacted them. Mm-hmm. Gutierrez denied that Green had ever told her this, and the court accepted her claims. After all, in most cases, a judge will take an attorney at their word. That said, the Court of Special Appeals noted that there was clear evidence that Gutierrez was aware of these alibi witnesses and their importance. One of them because he was listed on the state's witness list, and the other because she was mentioned in the grand jury testimony by the state's key witness. And therefore, the court found, Gutierrez should have, but did not, make an effort to contact these potential alibi witnesses. Both of the potential alibi witnesses were in fact called at the PCR hearing, and they indicated that they would have provided exculpatory testimony if they'd appeared at Green's trial. Unfortunately for Green, both of them also admitted that they were drug users with outstanding warrants who were trying to avoid the legal system. Therefore, the court found no prejudice. And not because Gutierrez had known these facts and made a reasoned decision not to call them, but because even if she had, they wouldn't have appeared. So it wasn't Gutierrez's performance that was approved of. It was simply that those witnesses, even had Gutierrez been doing her job, wouldn't have been there.
Yeah, I mean, this case to me, Susan, is a pretty significant discovery because it basically mirrors Adnan's case. I mean, in the end, it turns out these witnesses wouldn't have been cooperative, but that's not something that Gutierrez knew. This is a murder case like Adnan's case. This is a situation where we have multiple alibi witnesses, just like Asia McClain mentioned her boyfriend and friends. Gutierrez isn't investigating. And then the question is she lying or not? She told the judge that Green had failed to mention these alibi witnesses. He strenuously disagrees. Luckily, that's not the case with Adnan, where Asia McClain's name is in the files. But you know, even if we take Gutierrez at her word, there was evidence from the court. She knew about alibi witnesses in a murder case and made no effort whatsoever to contact these alibi witnesses.
And to back up for a moment, there are two important prongs of this test here. The first is that the attorney at issue was so bad that it was unconstitutional. And the second is that because the attorney was so bad, the defendant in the case didn't get the outcome he might have gotten otherwise. The court here wasn't finding that Gutierrez's performance was acceptable or that it met constitutional standards. It simply found the second part, that even if he'd had an attorney who was actually doing her job and actually taking basic steps that she should have, well, those two witnesses were, you know, on the run from the law. So they might not have showed up in the first place, which means that his attorney's deficient representation, it didn't matter in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just a lucky outcome for Gutierrez, where she's called out for deficient performance and for acting in a way that no reasonable attorney would act. But it just happens to be that if she had done what a reasonable attorney should have done, it would have been at least possibly a dead end. We're not sure. They said they were avoiding the trial process, but they might have cooperated if they were trying to free an innocent man. But yeah, it's a case of certainly deficient performance, and in a case where currently the claim is a deficient performance based upon failure to contact an alibi witness, it seems significant circumstantial evidence. And then after that Green case, 1996 was a relatively uneventful year for Gutierrez, at least in terms of cases that received the attention that would cause them to appear in a Google or a Westlaw search. In other words, you can look into the Maryland State case search and you can find other cases she handled, but there's no opinion that we can find to be able to say, okay, here are the facts of the case and here's what happened. What we do know from media stories is that Gutierrez spent much of 1996 working up the case of a mentally ill teenager who had been charged with both murder and accessory after the fact murder. That case eventually went to a jury trial and a jury verdict in early 1997. And it was a case where, depending upon how you view the facts, it was maybe a win, maybe a loss, maybe a draw. The jury eventually acquitted her on the higher charge of murder, but did convict on the lesser charge of accessory after the fact, resulting in, again, this mentally ill teen being institutionalized as opposed to imprisoned. And then later in 1997, we had Gutierrez's big case that year. We've already talked about it a good deal on a prior addendum, the addendum to episode 9. This was the case of Richard Nicholas. This again was the case of the father who was charged with murdering his daughter. It was also the case in which the state's medical examiner made the sort of astounding claim that lividity could be fixed within 2 hours. And then finally, it's the case in which after the trial, the prosecutor sent an email to the medical examiner saying the lividity evidence was the key to the state's case and that he had learned from a quote unquote unimpeachable source that Gutierrez did not understand the lividity evidence. Now, again, in terms of the present posture of this case, this is the case where earlier this year, the district court granted Nicholas a new trial based upon finding that Detective Massey and others had failed to disclose the existence of exculpatory statements by two ear witnesses who had heard what sounded like gunshots at a time when Nicholas was saying that a stranger had shot his daughter after an automobile incident. Now, in that opinion, you might recall, the court rejected the additional claim that Nicholas had received the ineffective assistance of counsel from Gutierrez based upon Gutierrez's failure to challenge the lividity evidence or to call her own medical examiner. Now, again, that's sort of interesting because you might recall when she was a public defender, Gutierrez was renowned for not only calling but overcalling and relying upon expert witnesses. And yet in this Nicholas case where the prosecution is saying the lividity evidence is everything, Gutierrez doesn't call a medical examiner trial. Now, once again, this is one of those cases where you wonder, is Gutierrez perjuring herself or not? We saw it in Merzbacher. We saw it in the Green case. It's the same thing here. Ultimately, the district court says Gutierrez said on the record, I contacted the medical examiner, but decided not to call that medical examiner as a witness at trial. The district court credited that. Currently, the case is being appealed by the state to the Fourth Circuit. They're going to review both the Brady claim that Massey and others failed to disclose the ear witness testimony. They're also going to review the ineffective assistance claim. And I wonder what perspective they might add in terms of whether Gutierrez, in fact, did consult with an expert witness. So that really brings to a close this period of 1995 to 1997. You know, again, after Gutierrez left Murphy's firm, her fortunes really changed. During those 9 years at Murphy's firm, she won the vast majority of her cases. What we presented here are not only really losing most of her cases, but in many of these cases, either borderline or actual misconduct. And again, these aren't cherry-picked. These are the cases from this period where we can find the facts and we can report on them. Again, there are some minor cases in the Maryland State case search system, but it's impossible for us to tell whether those were wins or losses. And at least, Susan, from my perspective, this period from 1995 to 1997 seems to me sort of an attorney who's coasting on her prior reputation with very little to show in the way of recent results for her clients.
Yeah, this is every single case we can find from this time period. And there could be more out there. They're obviously not big, high-profile ones. But the ones we do know of, she has a very unimpressive record, to say the least. And that's putting it mildly. And a lot of the accusations being made in these cases kind of remind me of the scene from her first trial, in which she says that she had not seen some cell phone records that were being put into evidence. And the judge calls her a liar. That resulted in the mistrial. And the question is, was Gutierrez telling the truth that she hadn't seen the records and admitting to being that incompetent? Or was she trying to lie for some obscure procedural advantage? The judge clearly thought it was the latter because he couldn't believe she'd be that incompetent. So he called her a liar and the jury overheard. And it's kind of repeating this pattern of judges who look at her cases and they have to decide perjury or incompetence. And it seems like a lot of the time they choose the answer that affirms the conviction.
Susan, what you mentioned with the mistrial, it's one of those cases, again, where you look at it and say, she has to be lying, because when Gutierrez is talking to the judge about not seeing the cell phone records, she seems to acknowledge that they actually were turned over to the defense. And her claim is simply, I didn't see the cell phone records in the sense that, according to her own words, I didn't care about them. I didn't care about the cell phone records. And that's why I didn't see them, not because they weren't turned over. And again, it's one of those cases where you look at it and say, how is it possible an attorney would act that way? And for many of these situations we're looking at here, it's the question of, Is she lying or is she acting in a way that's completely contrary to how a normal or even a mediocre attorney would act? And as you say, Susan, unfortunately, it seems that the way these are resolved usually goes against the client when, you know, you'd want to sort of give the client every benefit of the doubt.
To be clear, there was no procedural advantage to doing what Gutierrez did in that first trial. There's no reason that her saying she hadn't physically seen those documents, even though they'd come to her office, would have helped her side. But at the same time, I can see entirely why Judge Quarles would have assumed that, because it's incomprehensible that she hadn't actually looked at them. So he must have assumed, and I don't blame him, that she was making this up to try and score some obscure point. In 1998, Gutierrez's story took another turn, and things got worse still. She had her son and daughter move in with her parents in Towson, Maryland. This was only about 3 years after Gutierrez had quit Billy Murphy's firm in order to spend more time with her family. But according to Gutierrez, she had moved her children to her parents' house because she'd been getting death threats related to her cases. Earlier this year, however, her son gave an interview to the Baltimore Sun, and he wondered about this explanation. Although she wasn't officially diagnosed with multiple sclerosis until 2000, her son told reporter Justin George that he wouldn't be surprised if the effects of the disease began in 1998, about the same time that she moved his sister and he in with her parents in Towson. Gutierrez said his mother told them that she'd received death threats related to the cases. But now he wonders if they had moved because his mother knew her faculties were failing and needed help parenting. If Gutierrez knew that she had MS by the time she was representing Anand, it makes her role in another case even more interesting. In late 1999 through early 2000, the same time period as Anand's trials, Christina Gutierrez represented Melissa Carroll Deckelman, a former assistant to the president of the Maryland chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Deckelman allegedly wrote out 214 of the chapter's checks to herself in the time period from 1994 to 1998, embezzling $269,000 from the chapter and causing it irreparable harm. In December 1999, Gutierrez negotiated a plea deal, pursuant to which Deckelman agreed to enter an Alford plea, which, again, is a plea where the defendant doesn't admit guilt, but acknowledges that the state has enough evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If Gutierrez knew then that she had MS, you can only imagine what she was going through. In that same vein, we can at least get a little bit of insight into this from the interview with her son. He studied cell biology and molecular genetics in part because he wanted to learn about MS and diabetes, two conditions his mother had. According to him, MS has a huge effect on a person's ability to think and her memory, her ability to make judgments, said Gutierrez, who graduated from the University of Maryland. That's what my mom had, and towards the end of her career, she was definitely affected by that.
And honestly, I find it pretty interesting that Gutierrez's condition led her son to pursue these fields of study because there's actually something very similar in my family. My grandfather grew up in the Bronx, and like everyone else in his block, he was Jewish. And the story we were always told was that, in fact, growing up, he thought that everyone was Jewish. He went to serve in the army in World War II, and he suffered a rude awakening when he realized that his religion placed him in the minority and led to pretty bad mistreatment. And then upon returning from the war, he had another rude awakening. He was a sign painter on Long Island, but he couldn't keep the brush steady while he was painting the signs. He was eventually diagnosed with MS and sought benefits from the Department of Veterans Affairs, claiming MS was war-induced and thus what's known as a service-related disability. At first, as in many of these cases, the VA was reluctant to give him benefits, but he on his own sort of studied up in the law and he fought hard for years, eventually being given disability benefits. And it was hearing about this legal struggle that he had that eventually inspired me to become a lawyer. Now, luckily for my grandfather, he did get these disability payments, meaning he didn't have to work, which based upon the physical, the mental, the emotional toll of the disease made that impossible. Gutierrez, though, didn't have such benefits. She didn't have that luxury. And as her son notes, it might easily have been the case that in the late 1990s, she was, in fact, in the early stages of MS and didn't realize it. Overall, though, it's impossible to say exactly what was going on with Gutierrez in 1998. What we do know, though, is factually speaking, she started taking on a record number of tough cases at this point in time. Her mentor and colleague was Byron Warnken. He is a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and he was also quoted in this story about Gutierrez's son. According to the professor, he believes Gutierrez began to take on too many tough cases and everything, quote unquote, snowballed. Everybody wanted Christina Gutierrez and she couldn't say no. She wanted to do right for her clients. She wanted to do right for her kids, and she never got out from under. This basically coheres with my impression of Gutierrez, because if we look at it, 1998 really marked a shift from Gutierrez committing errors in certain cases to engaging in some cases, malpractice, and other cases, intentional fraud.
Let's start with the malpractice. In April 98, Lai Ong pled guilty to child abuse in exchange for the state's attorney agreeing to recommend a sentence of 15 years incarceration. Ong later hired Gutierrez to argue that his plea was involuntary so that he could withdraw it and take his chances at trial. In order to retain her, Ong signed over his retirement check of $14,705. Gutierrez, however, never actually moved to withdraw Ong's plea, and she also did not appear at a sentencing hearing. Instead, she sent her associate, and at the end of the hearing, Ong was sentenced to 20 years incarceration, with 5 years suspended in favor of probation. In other words, he got the same sentence he would have gotten under his initial plea bargain. After this result, Ong asked Gutierrez to return some or all of the amount he'd paid her, claiming that she hadn't done what she was paid to do. When Gutierrez refused, an action was brought against her with the Client Protection Fund, which is a fund created to provide relief to defrauded clients without requiring litigation or a lawsuit. Gutierrez claimed that she had in fact done an evidence review with Ong, at which point they had mutually agreed not to withdraw his plea. Ong claimed that no decision had been made to do that, and that even if it had, it shouldn't have cost anywhere close to $14,000. Gutierrez claimed that in addition to mutually deciding not to withdraw the plea deal, she'd also worked for Ong on a case in Anne Arundel. But Ong's client ledger didn't indicate that any work had been done there. The trustees of the Client Protection Fund found that Gutierrez had committed malpractice, but that's it. They didn't give Ong any money. According to an article in the Daily Record, when asked why Ong's claim was denied, Janet Moss, the Client Protection Fund administrator and sole paid claims investigator, said it lacks merit. Ms. Gutierrez did represent him, Moss said. That representation may have fallen short of what Ong wanted or expected, she added, but that's out of the fund's hands. We handle theft only, she said. We don't handle malpractice. The Court of Special Appeals of Maryland later agreed with this conclusion, finding that an attorney must engage in defalcation or embezzlement for a client to recover. And according to the court, defalcation always involves intent. In other words, a defalcation would exist if an attorney takes a fee from a client and performs no work. Specifically, with regard to flat fee arrangements, the fund maintains that there can generally be no defalcation whenever an attorney has rendered at least some legal service, even if the quantity or quality of service was not exactly what the client had in mind. Ong claimed that he was paying Gutierrez an hourly fee as opposed to a flat fee. That is, for each hour that Gutierrez worked on his case, he'd pay her her hourly rate. If that had been the case, there could have been a defalcation claim if Gutierrez had lied about doing work, even if she'd done some work, because even though she'd worked a few hours, she was charging him for more than she'd actually done. Gutierrez, however, claimed that she was paid a flat fee, that is, the entirety of Ong's retirement check. The court found that some of her actions in the case were more consistent with an hourly fee arrangement as opposed to a flat fee, and since Ong didn't have a copy of the legal services agreement, and Gutierrez claimed she didn't have a copy of it, there was no way to show otherwise. Therefore, the court found no defalcation.
Yes, you might wonder what would be an example of defalcation. Well, this takes us to what I would regard as a very curious development in Gutierrez's legal practice. Prior to 1998, I haven't been able to find any record of Gutierrez being involved in any case outside of Maryland. And we also haven't been able to find a record of Gutierrez handling more than a few murder cases at the same time. But now if we look to the time frame during which Gutierrez represented Adnan, she was handling a total of 8 murder cases, and those 8 murder cases were in 5 different jurisdictions. The first of these you've already heard about, a bit on serial. That was on October 2nd, 1998. 13-year-old Greg Whitman was brutally killed in his home in Pennsylvania. His 15-year-old brother Zachary was later charged with that murder. Gutierrez joined the case, and in fact, she was initially successful in moving to suppress certain evidence that was recovered from the Whitman residence after Zachary had called 911 on that fatal day of October 2nd. The state then appealed from that ruling, and Gutierrez tried to cross-appeal. In other words, she tried to claim that in addition to the evidence that had been excluded before, even more evidence should have been suppressed from trial. According to the Superior Court of Pennsylvania, this was a case of quote-unquote first impression, meaning there was no precedent on the issue in Pennsylvania, and therefore the briefs by the parties would be essential to resolving the case. So it was a case that desperately needed expertise, and Gutierrez assured the Whitmans that she was seeking it out and specifically getting it from, once again, Byron Wankrin, her old law school professor. But somehow things weren't quite working out. On September 22nd, 1999, Gutierrez's cross appeal was quashed, meaning that according to the court, she had done something wrong with her filing and the court wouldn't consider it. Then on March 28th, 2000, the Superior Court of Pennsylvania reversed the lower court's ruling and deemed the previously suppressed evidence to be admissible at trial. Now, again, you might recall that Sarah Koenig discussed this case on serial with the Whitmans saying that throughout the course of representation, they had asked Gutierrez to see briefs in advance of deadlines, and yet consistently Gutierrez was not producing them until the day of the deadline, meaning that oftentimes the Whitmans would have to drive down from their house in Pennsylvania, pick up their brief at the last minute, and then race up to the courthouse to file them. Eventually, there was a last deadline. This was the deadline to file an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, Gutierrez assured the Whitmans that she would have the brief and that Professor Wankrin was preparing the draft of the brief. Turns out that both of these statements were lies. Gutierrez never produced a brief, and Wankrin has confirmed to me recently that he never worked on the case at all. And according to Wankrin, this was not the first problem he'd had with Gutierrez. Instead, in a blog post, he noted that as tenacious as she was also a mess. She had too much going on and did not take care of herself. This was evident the times we worked together and saw each other socially. I saw firsthand some of the things Cyril described. She also failed to deliver on promises made to me on more than one occasion. And in fact, he is not the only person to make this type of statement. You might recall again on episode 10 of Serial that Sarah Koenig reported that a former law partner of Gutierrez told the Whitmans that Gutierrez had been slipping for a while, the last 5 years even. Now, this would mean, according to our timeline, that this decline started either right as she was leaving Billy Murphy's firm or soon after she started at her new law firm. So in other words, what the former partner observed is exactly the same trends we've noted in this episode, that after leaving Billy Murphy's firm, Gutierrez's performance first gradually and later dramatically started to decline in cases. In the end, in the Whitman case, the Whitmans were granted an extension by the Supreme Court, which allowed for a hastily filed brief to be filed by a new attorney. Ultimately, though, that brief was not accepted and the case was not taken up by the Supreme Court. What wasn't rejected, though, was the claim that the Whitmans eventually made to the client protection funds, and that was a claim for $40,000 based upon Gutierrez failing to file the brief to the Supreme Court and also failing to pay experts who were needed on a few key issues in the case. And so this was a case of defalcation. Gutierrez lied. She failed to produce work that she claimed would be produced, and she failed in a few regards with regard to expert witnesses in the case.
There's another case in 98 where Gutierrez had issues writing a brief. 18-year-old Selena Wiatrowski had been convicted of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment. Gutierrez was hired for $20,000 on August 5th, 1998 to file a petition for post-conviction relief. She was asking for a modification of sentence so that all but 20 years of the sentence would be suspended. which means rather than a life sentence, Witrowski would receive just 20 years. Months passed and no petition was filed. 98 turned into 99, which turned into 2000, and Gutierrez just kept telling Witrowski, or her mother, that she was still working on the petition. Eventually, at some point in 2000, the mother called Warnken because she was aware that he had worked on another case with Gutierrez, and she asked him why it was taking Gutierrez so long to file the petition. He responded that he couldn't think of a reason that a post-conviction filing would take more than 14 months. At the same time that the issues in the Whitman case were coming to a head, Witrowski's mother filed a claim for $20,000 with the Client Protection Fund. She received a full payment.
Yeah, now, Warnken, her old mentor and law professor, was eventually appointed to the case, and he told me that there was no evidence whatsoever that Gutierrez had done any work on the case. He also told me the appeal was fairly simple. It should have taken no more than a few months. That's, in fact, how long it took him, and the appeal was successful. The sentence was, in fact, modified so that all but 20 years of Witrowski's sentence was suspended. So this is a case where, for whatever period of time, 2 years, 20 months, Gutierrez, fairly simple PCR case, didn't do a single thing. And in the meantime, the teenage client was in prison based upon something that could have been and was quickly modified.
She'll be getting out soon.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1999, in addition to these two cases, and in addition to preparing for Anand's trial, Gutierrez was also juggling with another trial and a murder case in Maine. Howard student Joseph Glasgow was charged with murdering a co-worker at the Colony Hotel, and pursuant to a plea deal, he pled guilty to manslaughter. The sentencing hearing was held on August 20th, 1999, and Gutierrez seemingly spent a lot of time preparing for it. The hearing was described as unusual for its length, with Gutierrez calling two psychiatrists to testify that Glasgow should be sent to a hospital, not a jail. And the court disagreed, sentencing Glasgow to 15 years incarceration, with all but 6.5 suspended. This case wasn't necessarily a loss for Gutierrez, but the timing is interesting. Gutierrez didn't visit Anand in prison between July 10th, 1989 and September, presumably because of her involvement in the Glasgow case, many miles away. As we've noted before, the only dated reference to Asia McLean in the defense files comes from notes taken by a substitute clerk when he visited Anand on July 13th and 14th of 99. The clerk who more regularly visited Anand was sent by Gutierrez to see him in August of 99, the day after the trial ended in the main case. The memo from the interview makes clear that the regular clerk covered largely the same territory as the substitute clerk had done in July, which makes you wonder whether Gutierrez worked at all in Anand's case throughout July and August, and whether Asia McLean fell through the cracks in these repeated efforts by the clerks.
Yeah, I mean, that's my best guess, Susan, is that she really was focusing on the Glasgow case in July and August, and she somehow missed the clerk's notes from July 13th and 14th, and that's why the very day she gets back from Maine, she's having the regular clerk come in and basically ask the same questions that the clerk asked back in July.
I still find it significant that in her notes, there are pages that are clearly talking about Aisha. They have Aisha's last name, Aisha's address, Aisha's phone number, but the name listed is Asia.
Yeah, and on the subpoena information that we have in the files, it also says Asia, where it should be Aisha's name. And yeah, those are certainly two good explanations for why Asia would have fallen through the cracks. One, we have the repeated efforts based upon this other case she's working on. And two, maybe she confused Asia with Aisha.
At the same time, I don't give her a pass exactly on the Asia issue, but we know that at all times prior to trial, the prosecution was maintaining the steady drumbeat of Hay was last seen leaving campus at 3 p.m. All the news articles, all the reward poster info, everything out there said, hey, left school at 3 p.m. And the prosecution in its disclosures was, I think, deliberately vague and said things like, hey, was last seen leaving school shortly after school ended. We'll give more details if they become available. Well, no, they didn't. They never did. But prior to the first trial, Gutierrez could have recently thought that, you know, Asia was meaningless. Because based on what the state had said, and based on what she should have known at that point if the state was playing fair, Asia was meaningless. It just turned out that at trial, the prosecution was going to change its story and claim that Hay was killed at the exact time that made Asia relevant.
And now, as Susan just noted, Gutierrez didn't visit Adnan in prison between July 10th and September of 1999. On that latter visit, she also visited with another client. This was Marquise Matthews. Matthews was a Maryland man who was charged with first-degree murder after he fatally submerged his five-month-old son in scalding hot water in a bathtub. State's claim was this is intentional murder. Matthews' defense was this was an accident. He didn't realize how hot the water was. Eventually, Matthews pleads guilty to involuntary manslaughter on October 21st, 1999, at a hearing before Judge Quarles. This is the same judge that Susan referenced before, who called Gutierrez a liar at Adnan's first trial. As a result of Matthews' plea, he was given a sentence of 10 years incarceration. And so, Susan, it's sort of an interesting counterpoint here where, disputably, Matthews killed the child. We have a question about the mens rea, whether it was intentional or not, but his sentence is 10 years. He presumably has been out for a number of years now, whereas Adnan, who had his case go to trial, as far as we can tell, unless justice comes about through this PCR, he's going to be in prison for the rest of his life. Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. There's a well-recognized phenomenon known as the trial penalty, which says people fail much worse when they go to trial than when they accept a plea. And certainly this is a vivid illustration of that. But sometimes it's even worse when a person goes to trial. In the fall of 99, Gutierrez was also seeking to become involved in a death penalty case. This one was out of Alabama. Levi Pace had actually previously been convicted of first-degree murder back in 1996, but that conviction was thrown out based upon racial discrimination in the selection of grand jury forepersons. When the charges were brought again, the death penalty was again on the table, and Gutierrez applied to represent Pace in Alabama. Initially, though, in the fall of 1999, when she applied, it led to, in 2000, February 11th, 2000, the judge rejecting her being admitted to represent him in Alabama. He concluded that, "I read some of the articles that were attached to her resume, particularly the one with regard to her prior theft conviction and her lying to the Bar Association. That was primarily reason number one. I know she was ultimately admitted. She was admitted and then it came up and she was brought up on charges, I believe, as I recall it, and it just didn't sit well with me. Frankly, I didn't think she could bring to this case any help to Mr. Pace, and I just investigated what my duty and responsibility was in the case and found that it was discretionary. I looked for some basis that would, you know, what I was required to do to avoid an abuse of discretion and felt like I was within the discretionary bounds in making the call that I made, and I made it and I'm going to stand by it." So Gutierrez later appealed this to the Court of Criminal Appeals of Alabama. In August 2000, the Supreme Court of Alabama agreed with Gutierrez and said, "Okay, you can represent Pace because despite your problems during being admitted, you haven't been disbarred, you haven't been disciplined." Turns out Gutierrez never actually represented Pace because soon thereafter she was hospitalized, diagnosed with MS, and then Supreme Court of Alabama saying she's never been disbarred. Well, just a few months later, in fact, she was disbarred. But before we get to that, Susan, we have these three other cases that Gutierrez was handling in 1999 and 2000. They were all first-degree murder cases, and they all took place in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it just seems like there's a long string of people who are trying to sound the alarm about her, and they never got taken seriously enough.
Yeah, and I think in the Puerto Rico cases, we see sort of the same story playing out that we see in these other murder cases during 99 and 2000. The first of these was David Vega Molina. On February 9th, 2000, so in the middle of Adnan's second trial, Gutierrez agreed to represent him. He was one of several defendants charged with a robbery, hostage-taking, murder. When the First Circuit reviewed the case, it noted the obvious. There was little evidence against Molina other than a confession by a co-conspirator that also implicated Molina. Now, this is the type of case where it's abundantly clear what defense counsel should do pre-trial, and that's move for a severance, meaning, in other words, that Molina is given a separate trial from his alleged co-conspirator who made the confession. And that's because under the Confrontation Clause, there are issues under the Bruton Doctrine with admitting the confession of a co-conspirator at a joint jury trial. Now, Gutierrez, you might recall, as we mentioned before in the Craig case, she is the one who successfully argued the Confrontation Clause up to the Supreme Court. So she certainly should have recognized this issue and moved to sever Molina's trial. And indeed, another attorney who was representing another co-conspirator in a case did just that, filing the motion that Gutierrez did not file. The consequence is that Molina is convicted when his co-conspirator's admission is read into evidence. And now at this point in time, Gutierrez was not the attorney. She had been disbarred. She's also not the attorney when years later Molina was released. She had passed away. And why was Molina eventually released years later? Because of the Confrontation Clause violation. Now, certainly we can't pin what happened at trial on Gutierrez, but again, a lawyer with her experience with the Confrontation Clause going before the Supreme Court, she should have recognized what another attorney recognized in the case. This is a case where the confession was the most powerful evidence. If there was any risk of coming to evidence, she should have moved to sever, and she never made that motion.
Now, a little bit earlier, a week before a non-second trial began, Gutierrez also agreed to take on another case, also in Puerto Rico, this one for Angel Bernicet Cosme, on January 14th, 2000. The timing of this representation is interesting because Urich called out Gutierrez at trial for failing to respond to phone calls by prosecution witnesses who had also been subpoenaed by the defense. Part of Gutierrez's response was that she had been out of town for a large chunk of that time, and the Cosme case makes it clear that she was actually in Puerto Rico, probably. And you wonder how much trial prep she could have done in Anand's case in between the two trials. Now, the week before trial, especially in a trial of this scale in a murder case, she should have been immersed in Anand's case. At the very least, she should not have been handling other murder trials in other jurisdictions. Cosme was charged with first-degree murder, though, and the prosecution indicated that it was going to pursue the death penalty. And because it was a death penalty case, bail was denied, and the state successfully argued in February that the Speedy Trial Act deadline didn't apply. And that's because of the large amount of time and trial prep that goes into capital cases. Later that spring, however, the state informed the defense that it was no longer pursuing the death penalty. This should have immediately prompted Gutierrez to argue that the Speedy Trial Act did apply and that Cosme should be given bail. That notice, however, was not given until 2001. According to the court's opinion in January of that year, the court was first notified that this was no longer a death penalty case when Bernicet stated in his present motion that at some unspecified date, the government had decided against seeking the death penalty. Bernicet should have informed the court of this change as soon as it happened. Accordingly, the court finds Bernicet's claim of Speedy Trial Act violation unavailing.
Yeah, and of course, Susan, when the court says Bernicet should have informed the court of this change as soon as it happened, they really mean that Bernicet's attorney, in other words, Gutierrez, should have done this. And yeah, again, it's another failure there in early 2000, right at the time that Adnan's case is being heard, that she's wearing so many different hats, all these different trials in these different jurisdictions. What's Puerto Rico law? What is Alabama law? What is Maine law? And you can just imagine how she had so many plates in the air, it was tough to keep any of them up and keep them from falling and cracking. And it seems that in every one of these cases, the plates fell and they cracked and it caused significant harm.
So what's the grand total here? From May of 99, when Gutierrez first began to get involved in this case, and May when she first became his official attorney, until the end of his trial in February of 2000, how many murder cases did she take on?
Well, so far we've discussed seven murder trials plus the PCR where she was handling the Wiatrowski murder PCR. And then there's this eighth case. There's this eighth and final case in Puerto Rico. This case actually started in 1999, and it was the case where she was lead counsel for Hector Acosta Martinez. And speaking of these different plates in the air, there's a memo from a law clerk dated September 16th, 1999, which indicates that Gutierrez was confusing this case with Adnan's case. That memo states, please put the correct client number on the phone/witness list for the reference case. The Syed phone/witness list currently lists Acosta Martinez client matter number. As Gutierrez was appointed in the Acosta Martinez case, all costs and expenditures will most likely be scrutinized. Thanks. Now, Susan, the main question in the Acosta Martinez case was whether the Federal Death Penalty Act applied in Puerto Rico, trumping the island nation's ban on capital punishment. Because you see, Puerto Rico, they've always been opposed to the death penalty. They never had it when they were under Spanish occupation. When the U.S. took over during the Spanish-American War in 1898, they installed the death penalty. But Puerto Rico later abolished the death penalty in 1929, and in its Bill of Rights, they simply stated the death penalty shall not exist. But the question here was, as the sovereign, can U.S. law, federal law trump it, and can Acosta Martinez and other Puerto Rican citizens be given the death penalty? Well, in this case, in early 2000, Gutierrez was successful. She argued that Puerto Rican law cannot be overcome by federal law, and therefore the death penalty doesn't apply. Prosecution later appealed to the First Circuit, and as in the Whitman case, the court noted this is an issue of first impression, meaning once again, there's no case law on the issue, the attorney's briefs would be key, and while the state submitted a brief, Acosta Martinez never filed a brief for the First Circuit. So what happened? Well, a default order was sent to Gutierrez on March 28, 2001. It was returned to the court on April 2, 2001 with the message refused, company going out of business. No forwarding information supplied. So Acosta Martinez was appointed an attorney at the last minute, but unlike in the Whitman case, it was too late for the attorney to file a brief. So in this case, there was no brief by Gutierrez. It was too late to file a brief. Without briefing from this defendant, the First Circuit ruled the Federal Death Penalty Act applies in Puerto Rico. As a result, Puerto Rican citizens can be given the death penalty. Susan, this is sort of everything coming to a head here. This is the Whitman case, the Wiatrowski case. In early 2001, Gutierrez is nowhere to be found, and the firm is refusing this default order that's being sent to it. And it's sort of interesting because it ties into what we know, what was going on at Gutierrez's law firm at the time. Yeah, and so what was going on with Gutierrez's firm? Why was this notice saying the company was going out of business? Well, in September 1999, Gutierrez's firm was named Redmond, Bergen, and Gutierrez. Those were the three named partners, and they were joined by three other attorneys. Earlier in the year, there were additional attorneys. One attorney who worked exclusively for Gutierrez left the firm in February. Another attorney who was working on Adnan's case and in fact had visited him twice in prison, left the firm in July 1999. Then in October 1999, Bergen, one of the three named partners, left the firm. We don't know the circumstances, but whenever a named partner leaves a firm, especially a firm with this few attorneys and this few partners, that's going to be disruptive for a few reasons. Then we can fast forward to February 2nd, 2001. This was the point at which things were really escalating for Gutierrez. We noted the problems with the Whitman case before, but this is when the Supreme Court brief isn't filed. This is when the Wiatrowski claims are coming to the forefront. On this day, February 2nd, 2001, Redmond, the one remaining named partner in the firm, files a lawsuit against Gutierrez seeking to garnish her property to the tune of almost $59,000 plus interest. And the lawsuit is successful. We don't know the details, but it seems like Gutierrez somehow was borrowing money from the law firm for personal use and never repaid it. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what was going on there.
It looked like Gutierrez's partner used a confession of judgment, or the Maryland equivalent, in order to obtain the judgment against Gutierrez, which means that this was kind of planned in advance. To get sort of a fast-forward judgment, there's a way you can add a clause into contracts that says, if you don't pay back by X date, then I can instantly file and get a judgment without going through a trial. And that's not a standard contract term, not the first time parties are dealing with one another, and it's definitely not a standard term to have in a contract between partners at a law firm, which to me strongly suggests that there was some prior trouble going on and that there had been an attempt to fix this before and it hadn't worked out. And as a result, this judgment that Redmond got had been planned for in an agreement between Gutierrez and him and the firm, probably to pay back some money she owed that she never did.
Yeah, and you know what we know is, again, these attorneys working for Gutierrez left the firm. There's a third attorney who was working with Gutierrez on the case after the prior two attorneys left, and she left for the public defender's office in 2000. I'm not sure if it was during Adnan's trial, but you get the sense of a sinking ship. These aren't people who were replaced with other attorneys. Gutierrez was relying upon law students to do a lot of the work that otherwise attorneys would have been doing. It certainly seems to me that this was something that did not suddenly come about, that this was something over the course of a few years the people at the firm were starting to recognize.
This takes us to the disbarment. Gutierrez never self-reported the issue she was having, and it wasn't her clients that reported her. Instead, another lawyer, unidentified, informed the Attorney Grievance Commission that Gutierrez was too sick to handle her practice. And you know, I have to wonder, was it one of her partners? They would have known best, and they were the ones fleeing the ship. But some attorneys saw what was going on and finally informed the commission that there were big problems here. And at that point, Gutierrez was blind in one eye and could barely walk. As a result of this report by the attorney, the commission took over Gutierrez's client files, and once they started looking at them, they realized that the client money that should have been there wasn't there. At the same time, about a dozen clients complained to the commission that they had paid Gutierrez, but that she hadn't actually filed their pleadings. On May 24, 2001, Gutierrez was disbarred by consent after the number of claims against her had risen to 16. By June 20th, 20 clients had filed claims against her, and the fund's administrator believed this to be a record number of complaints. Gutierrez refused to admit any wrongdoing, and in reference to the Whitman case, she cited the tremendous amount of work she had done on it. And with regards to the Witrowski case, she said that sometimes PCR petitions take years to complete. This was not the first time that Gutierrez had denied wrongdoing, and in the 94 Baltimore Sun article, she had steadfastly denied that she was guilty of shoplifting and asserted that she had pled guilty because she was in a bad spot. Gutierrez's claims back in 82 had convinced a majority of the justices in the Court of Appeals for Maryland that she was qualified to be an attorney. Only Justice Smith had dissented, forecasting exactly the arc that her career would take. In addition to Ong, 38 former clients brought claims with the Client Protection Fund. Nine of these claims were denied. Only Ong appealed, so we only have a record of his claim. As his claims make clear, in these cases that were denied, Gutierrez might have committed malpractice or done other bad acts. She just hadn't done defalcation.
On the other hand, 29 of these claims were sustained. So that means that 29 separate clients were affirmatively able to prove that Gutierrez intentionally defrauded them out of their money. It might have been a case of doing no work. It might have been a case of failing to do particular work. It might have been, as with some of the experts in the Whitman case, hiring someone and then sticking the client with a bill. Eventually, these 29 clients were paid a total of $269,235, nearly the exact same amount that Gutierrez's former client had stolen from the Maryland chapter of the Multiple Sclerosis Society. Now, I've checked into this. The Client Protection Fund says that specific case information is confidential, so we don't have the details about the time frame for many of these other cases, but we do have the Witrowski case and we do have the Whitman case. Witrowski again, Gutierrez started representation in August 1998. That was 8 months before she took Adnan's case. If we go with Professor Warnken's general estimate, Gutierrez should have been done with the PCR brief at most 14 months later, October 1999, squarely within her representation of Adnan. Instead, as we know, she did no work whatsoever and consistently lied to her client about the work that was being done. The Whitman case also started in 1998, either late 1998 or 1999, early in the year. Gutierrez committed fraud. The experts that were the issue in the case were in connection with a hearing on whether Whitman, Zach Whitman, would be trialed in juvenile or adult court. So that was probably early 1999 when this fraud took place. Later, September 1999, that was when she first started to have issues with the brief she was filing, the cross appeal that was quashed, lying about speaking with the professor about the brief and having him write a draft. So again, this is all during the same time frame she represented Adnan. This is not stuff happening after the fact. It's squarely within that 1999-2000 time frame. Eventually, though, things did take a turn for a worse for Gutierrez. We know she was disbarred in 2001. We know her condition worsened, as Susan noted a minute ago. A few years later, January 31st, 2004, Cristina Gutierrez passed away. At this point, in addition to MS and diabetes, she had contracted cancer, but eventually it was a heart attack that took her life. Her parents and all nine of her siblings were with her in the hospital room when she passed away. And I think, I mean, Susan, what we've been trying to do here is to present a complete picture of Gutierrez. I think it's very much a case of someone who certainly was stubborn and who in her later years wasn't willing to admit that her physical and mental condition was deteriorating, and that caused, you know, a record number of clients to suffer. As again, her former mentor and colleague Byron Wanker notes, though, serial should not define her. Her legacy is going to be a mixed message. Here she was not born with a silver spoon in her mouth, for sure, and by her bootstraps became one of the best and most feared criminal defense attorneys in the country, certainly this state. It's kind of sad that all this got away from her. And I think that's the bottom line. It's sad for Gutierrez, it's sad for her family, and it's sad for the clients. I mean, this is people who put their life into her hands. That's what Adnan has said, is, you know, someone in prison, you're putting your life in someone's hands. And as Justice Smith noted, this is why honesty and integrity is so key in an attorney, is that all of these people trusted Gutierrez, and with good reason. She had a great reputation for many years, but it was that stubbornness and that inability to admit fault and mistake that I think eventually was her downfall. And again, that downfall affected so many people, their families' lives, their lives, and it's a mixed message, it's a mixed legacy. It's just really tough to see what happened in this person's life.
She's such a complicated and tragic figure, and I flip-flop on how I view her. On the one hand, sometimes I do have sympathy for her, and it seems like she was a respected and ferocious attorney who, by the end of her career, was falling apart. And then I remember her theft when she stole from dozens of clients. So I don't know what to think of her. I don't know. You can't excuse stealing from clients as merely a sign of illness or merely just her getting out of her depth or things spiraling out of control. She was stealing from clients. And then she was also simultaneously doing a poor job as an attorney. And I feel like in Anand's case, we have, on the one hand, an attorney who was very concerned with the money. If you look at her files, you can see repeatedly there's notes about how, make sure to ask Anand's parents for $10,000 more, to the exclusion of more important things going on in this case at the time. And then you have an attorney who I think was genuinely trying to do her best at trial. I think she hadn't yet recognized her own limitations due to her illness. And I think she thought she was capable of walking into the courtroom, putting on a show, and walking away. But you can tell from the transcripts, she's flailing. Again, those instincts are there. And you can see at times when she tries to zero in on something key, but it never comes together.
Yeah, and Susan, in the end, for me, it's one of those things, again, we've mentioned several of these crossroads in this case. You always wonder with Gutierrez, is it one thing or another? We have basically, adding everything up, around $320,000 or $330,000 if you're combining the money that she embezzled from her clients and the money she had borrowed from the people at her firm. And, you know, you wonder where it went. Maybe some of it for medical bills, but is there some other untold story? We have, you know, a third of $1 million basically unaccounted for, and We have Gutierrez, as we said, in 98, 99, taking on this record number of cases in far-flung jurisdictions. It feels like maybe there's some other narrative out there that we are not able to grasp. But again, it's one of those things where we can't tell whether there's something else going on that might tend to explain this broader picture.
And as far as I've seen and as far as I've heard, she wasn't living beyond her means, not visibly. There's no obvious sign of where the money was going. So what was happening to it?
I think that that's precisely what that Ms. Gutierrez is trying to do. She's trying to lay the foundation through which...
Help me, it's been so long since we started the trial. I don't remember which one of the names.
Is this something we need to discuss with your client?
No.
Present?
No, I don't think so.
Is it a scheduling matter?
Sort of.
You sure you don't need your client here?
I don't need my client here. I just, Judge Mike, the rest of my cross is not going to be that long on this witness. Over the break, I went and I ate lunch. I don't know if the court's aware. I'm a diabetic. And
you okay?
Well, I'm not sure. I had lunch. Things seemed to be fine. I was going to say something to the court anyway. Because yesterday, eating so late is something that throws me off, and I should have stopped, and I didn't. I felt fine, but oftentimes I just have bad reactions a day or so later. I was fine. I left. We walked back, and by the time I got in the building, I was overwhelmed and had to vomit. I didn't feel like walking up to my office where my blood sugar tester is, so what I would like to do is to finish cross of this witness, which I don't think will take long, let them do whatever, redirect. And then ask the court to take a short break. I would like to walk up to my office
That's
and
fine.
Test my blood sugar and see if there's anything I can do. My medication's up there and see if I can clear it up.
But that'll be fine. You have no problem with that, do you? And I would tell you that if you want, depending on what is going on, we can stop.
Yes, I know, but I'm not. I just don't know, and it's early fine. Enough that if I walk up, fine. It may pass and I'll be fine.
Fine.
To tell him that you were busy at the time it was outside your house, parallel in the street to where you were inside the car but not blocking it, was the business of getting Jay Wild his dinner at a certain time?
Objection. I have no idea what you just asked.
People often ask me if Adnan's life and story will be turned into a movie. I mean, it's certainly a possibility, but I kind of wish a movie could be made about Tina's life, too. She terrified me the few times I interacted with her, but her personal story is no less compelling to me than Adnan's. So where are we now in the chronology of the case? Adnan has been arrested, arraigned, bail's been denied. Tina is now representing him for the fight of his life. And that fight will depend heavily on what happens in the next 8 months or so, the very vital time leading up to his trial. It's in the pre-trial and discovery phase that Tina will have to figure out what actually happened on January 13, 1999, and build a defense for her client. Her role in this case, her failures in it, have haunted me for years. I've said many times publicly that if a single part of the justice system worked properly, Adnan never would have been convicted. I know that we heard it said in Serial that Adnan must be the unluckiest guy ever if all of this happened to him, but the thing is, every person who has ever wrongfully been convicted and the tens of thousands of wrongfully convicted people in prison right now are in the same boat as Adnan. They are not all unlucky to the point of disbelief. They are victims of every part of that system, from the failures of cops to prosecutors to their defense counsel. Because in Adnan's case, I believe if just one of those parts had performed properly, if Tina had performed properly, his life would have been radically different. But now, as Tina prepares for trial, at every turn, she ends up missing chances to put key evidence together. and either fails to see or to do anything about not being given information she needs from the state. Because remember, the prosecution was also fighting every step of the way to make Adnan's defense as difficult as possible. Next time on Undisclosed.
Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer, and you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.